This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hello and welcome to Watch It. My name's Elise McCready. I would like to acknowledge that we are meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to the elders past and present and to the elders of all communities. I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel today. Andrew Knight, sitting next to me, a man responsible for some of our most loved television shows, from The D Generation to Sea Change to Jack Irish and Rake. In fact, as a writer-producer, I think Andrew's responsible for over 1,000 hours of Australian television.
Every single one of them good.
And in the last year alone, he was writing concurrent seasons of Rake and Jack Irish, whilst also scripting three features, including Mel Gibson's latest Hacksaw Ridge. Vicky Madden, next to Andrew, is a producer, writer and showrunner with over 20 years' experience here and in the UK. Her credits include Halifax, The Bill, Trial and Retribution, The Clinic, Water Rats and Sea Patrol, among others. Most recently, Vicky has just completed her own 8-part series, The Kettering Incident, a supernatural thriller series for Foxtel. It's a haunting, bold, original series that has had stunning critical and rating success. And on the very end, we have Michael Shanks. Michael curates the popular YouTube channel Tim Tim Fed, which features a variety of high-concept film and comedy content and has over 35 million views. He's an award-winning writer, director, musician and visual effects artist. He's won various awards for his work in music videos. And most recently, he created the magnificent and extremely funny SBS 2 series, The Wizards of Oz, which he directed, co-wrote, acted, composed and produced visual effects for. So I'd like to start with a quote from David Fincher, who was the showrunner for House of Cards, who said, "The world of 7:30 on Tuesday nights, that's dead. A stake has been driven through its heart. Its head has been cut off and its mouth has been stuffed with garlic. The captive audience is gone. If you give people this opportunity to mainline all in one day, there's reason to believe they will do it." So, as we all know, there's been a seismic shift in TV in the last probably 15 years. We've gone from a landscape of unchanging TV characters who cure the disease, solve the crime or break the case, all within the neat confines of the television hour, to the sprawling complex narratives that can now take up to 20 episodes to unfold. We can trace this back to the US cable networks and in particular HBO with the groundbreaking Sopranos at the start of this century. But there have been many other shifts, the emergence of box sets, quickly replaced by iTunes, which in turn was quickly trounced by Netflix, illegal downloads, explosion of web series, and let's not forget the ever-expanding size of the home television screen. So I'd like to open up tonight's discussion by asking our panel, firstly, how these transformations have affected their own writing and storytelling. I might start with you, Vicky. When writing, how aware are you of how an audience might watch or consume, whether it's binge watching, streaming, and does that affect the writing or creating story process?
Yes, it does. It depends what show you're working on, of course. And when I was writing Kettering, I sat down and really looked at all the shows that I binge-watched, especially Scandi Noirs. I mean, I think you can tell with Kettering that I'm a big fan of the Scandis. So I was really fascinated to know what it was that made me binge-watch till 4 in the morning when I should have been sleeping, and how they manage that. And so I was very aware, but it was more for me because I kind of always have this theory, if you know, write for yourself and you plot for yourself and you tell stories you like, then there's going to be a few people out there that like that. So for me it was finding the shows that that I really connected to, and so I'm very aware in that sense of the audience and the genre. You know, we were kind of pushing a hybrid genre, which there weren't a lot of precedents for, you know, and I kind of worked overseas and really studied those. So it was a matter of trying to wrangle the whole thing and and try also to bring in two audiences, like the crime audience, you know, that base audience you never want to lose, and bring in the supernatural and sci-fi audience and try and blend those two, which isn't easy, you know, because you don't want to lose... you want to introduce one and not lose the other. So, yeah, I was very aware of the audience and what I was trying to attempt.
Mm. What about you, Andrew? Do you think about those? So, do you think about how an audience is going to view your work?
Oh, no, I try not to. I just hope they do. What I've always tried to do, and it's now got easier, is I try to look for themes that seem to be out in the world and then build or shape a series around it. For example, when we did, Deb and I did Sea Change, we sort of looked at the world and it was a time of massive global corporate greed, and thank God that's gone. And we realised the trouble with the left was you could never present an alternative lifestyle that looked in the least bit interesting. And so we set out to do a series that talked about the nobility of small lives. And that sort of shaped the series. But in the old days of television, you used to have to write just volumes of stuff because networks would demand things like 26 hours or 13 hours, and by which time, whatever theme you'd thought of had been completely lost. So the landscape's changed so much now that, you know, if Peter Duncan and I set out to do a series of Rake, we kind of can say, well, that's what we want to cover in this short period, and we don't have to, you know, you end up doing soap if you run into a fifth series anyway, but you... It's helped shape the way we write now. Yeah,
it seems the 6 to 8 part series is much more in demand now, really, from networks.
Yeah, in fact, you don't actually get offered 26 part series anymore.
No,
which is, I think, a shame for young writers starting out because it's such a good training ground. You're allowed to fail and allowed to do bad episodes and allowed to. You learn your craft. I mean, Vicky and I both learned our stuff on longer-running shows. And that opportunity's not there. I'd be really interested to hear what you've got to say about all that.
Let's go to Michael.
About the loss of the long series to write.
Yeah. Well, not even... No, just generally how you get a start now. How did you go?
My original start actually came straight out of high school. I looked at a lot of video game websites, which might be really surprising for how cool I look. But there was a video game website I went on that had like funny video game related content, and they were running a competition. There was a film competition, and the winner got a contract to make a show for them. And I was 17, and I was like, oh, I could do this. It's more fun than getting laid. And I just knew that my options were better of winning the competition. And so I entered this competition and won, funnily enough. The competition was rubbish, obviously. And that's how I kind of got my start, is I then had to write a 25-episode comedy series for the internet, which was pretty cool. But it was short episodes. It started as 5 minutes, and by the end of it, I got so self-indulgent that it ended as 30. But then kind of beyond that, moving out of that weird little space, I started writing sketches. And sort of to your question earlier about like being aware of what medium you're trying to appeal to, that was a really important thing for me when coming up with a sketch, was to make sure it was instantly gratifying to the viewer and as short as possible, because I knew that it was going to be coming out on people's Facebook feeds, and so as people are scrolling down, they're going to probably see 2 seconds of it accidentally, as we all do, and then end up being like, I wonder what is the cutest cat of this week or whatever it is. And like, this was actually kind of before Facebook took off when I first started, and it was based on Your sketches would do well if people would share them on Reddit. And I sort of knew from my own internet habits that if I were to click on a little sketch or a little random thing made by somebody I'd never heard of, if it went longer than 3 minutes, I probably was like, oh, it's probably not worth it. I've got much more important things to do. There's a lot of porn on the internet. And so I tried to make things as short as possible and would make 30-second sketches. And those were the ones that would do well and get maybe a million views or whatever. But and then, you know, transitioning to longer form was something that I really wanted to do because I sort of felt like a hack, and I still absolutely am, just making kind of little goofy sketches online. So I made the goofiest show ever to be online. And even then, like, to the question of length, when I wrote with my writing partner, The Wizards of Oz, which is the series that I most recently made, it was written for the web because I had no way into the television landscape. There was no way for me to pitch for a TV show. I didn't have that capability. But there was a way for me to get web funding. So we wrote a 6-part, 15-minute-long episode series. But then SBS caught wind that it might have been quite okay, and they picked it up to broadcast it in 30-minute-long slots. And that was awesome because I was like, ha-ha, I've done it. I'm on television. Look at me now, Mum. You can't. You burnt to death. That's a lie. But if we'd written it to be on TV in the first place, we would have written it to be 30 minutes in length because it was weird suddenly having two disparate 15-minute-long arcs that just kind of played on TV at once.
It's really interesting listening to what you're saying because it's almost like there's two ends to this sort of revolution of television. One is the short attention, you know, grab the audience because they're so distracted and there's so much else going on and we have to do these really quite, I don't know, standout things. And the other is the more the Scandi side of it, which is the long, long form television, which, you know, the crime took 20 episodes to solve.
Yeah.
So it's like they're very disparate ideas of where television and maybe that middle landscape is not there. I'm not sure, but
I suspect it's age related.
Perhaps.
I know that when I write a series, the ABC is constantly saying address a younger audience, and they're obviously not looking at me. I know that the audience I address, and they don't look all that dissimilar to me. Occasionally, they've inflicted some of my programs on their children. But the idea at the moment on television, commercial television, certainly, and but particularly on the ABC, there just needs to be more stuff that young people do, and then the hope that you might drag them back. But I would think that a lot of television just doesn't engage young people. None of my kids are the least bit interested in it. I think my kids think I work in real estate. They have literally no idea what I do.
Do you think there's more freedom, like in something like Wizards of Oz, in mm-hmm. terms of having notes? And I remember reading something Kevin Spacey said about House of Cards. They shopped that round to all the different networks and they all said, you need to do a pilot, blah, blah, blah. They didn't want to do a pilot. Netflix said, you don't need a pilot. You know, you're Kevin Spacey. And someone asked him, you know, did you get notes from the network from Netflix on the scripts? And he said, God, no, but if it had been at a network, imagine the notes. You know, and we're really worried Kevin strangles a dog in the first 3 minutes, you know. So there's this sense that there's a freedom with perhaps, you can say there isn't, but perhaps there's more freedom for creatives or showrunners within the streaming or the web world?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose from a budget point of view, it's often lower stakes as well. So there's less need for notes for those people who are really protecting their finances. Like when we got our funding from Screen Australia, it was the sort of funding whereupon any profits made we reaped. So there was no chance of Screen Australia getting it back. That said, we certainly got feedback from Screen Australia, but it was very much supportive. It was the opposite of the kind of hacky idea of studio notes that we all kind of like to receive. And then by the time SBS came on board, we had already shot the show, so the notes couldn't have been really taken on board even if they'd had a whole ream of them. So we kind of beat the system like that in a bizarre way.
What about you, Vicky, on Kettering? Did you find that Foxtel or, you know, well, that was the network, was there a lot of input?
Not really, not in terms of commercial TV, you know, and the ABC has a lot of input as well. I think we got lucky in a way because Foxtel were looking for... They needed a couple of shows to really push their, you know, their brand into the bold and to step up to, I guess, the challenges that Netflix were putting out and that HBO were doing at the time. And we went in with this big, bold concept and definitely wanted to do a show that was, big and expensive. And so they kind of... They, you know, read the outline and, you know, thought it would be a lot harder to sell, but I just made sure to keep the crime of the spine of it so that, you know, you always have to pitch something that people recognise, even though they say we want something new and different. You still have to have something that's vaguely familiar. So they kind of, I think, treated Kettering as that strange child in their lineup. So they had their stable, you know, big popular shows. And I think Kettering, they let, even though it was big and expensive, they sort of kept their hand in. But they kind of were pretty good considering what we were trying to do and what we were going in with every week. And, you know, so we didn't have to, you know, wait for too much feedback. They would, Penny Wynn would just ask, you know, sensible questions that were questions, not so much, you can't do this and you have to do that. So I felt quite lucky that we managed to make the show we did in Australia.
Because you were very much a showrunner or auteur on that show.
Yeah.
And how was that experience compared to, say, working on some of the other shows that you've done in terms of networks and notes? And
look, it was good. It was really trying for so many reasons. First, our location being Tasmania was untried and untested, and first day our unit truck tipped over because of the landscape and it was snowing the first week, and you know, and everyone was very excited about the show, and I think we all kind of were pushing the envelope so much that we were out at Bruny Island and got stuck out there, and there was a lot of things like that. So right up front we realised how much we'd bitten off just in that, and then we had to fly most of the heads of department, but also trucks and camera equipment, and everything had to be flown down. So it was hugely challenging. And for me, trying to make something different was, I think the biggest challenge was trying to convince people to go there. I was very geared up. I'd been overseas prior for about 6 years, and I'd come back really wanting to do something. It was either that or go back overseas, I think. So I was really pushing this envelope, and I was lucky enough to get Andrew on board as well, and you know, he read the script and rang up and said something like, what is this, you know, I've not seen kind of this before, can we go there, you know? And I said yeah, and you know, when you say that to Andrew Knight, you know you're going to go there. So we had a good time, but it was challenging on so many levels, you know, trying to get the supernatural through, get the balance right and all of that. So, and writing, you know, I was writing most of the scripts as well. So I was having very long nights. It was tough.
Do you think that show would have been made in Australia 5 years ago?
No.
No.
Can you talk a little about how it's become possible to make? Because landscape suddenly has become very much a part of high-end TV. If you look at, you know, shows like Fortitude or Broadchurch, you know, the landscape's becomes a character, which is very much in the Kettering incident.
Yeah, I had, as I said, I'd been overseas for quite a while and working in Ireland and seeing how they made TV, even over there, you know, with their smallish budgets, but, you know, being away from a mainland kind of thing. And I'd never seen I grew up in Tasmania, so I'd never seen my world on screen, my Australia, I suppose. So, and because I'd seen a few of the Scandi shows, and one of the things that stands out, I think, in those kind of shows, is that connection to the land that they do so well. And I thought if anywhere I could do that, it would be Tasmania. And I was thinking of writing it as a film, first of all. But I think it's, you know, it's the introduction of... I mean, Foxtel have been around a while, but they haven't been making the, you know, the big budget shows. You know, people used to get Foxtel mainly for the sport, really. And I do think it's just the influence of HBO and those big shows. And look, you know, I think the only thing that's been holding us back in Australia, I think it has been a network thing, budget-wise, because we've certainly got, you know, the talent, and there's a lot of frustrated writers. So it's fantastic that we're getting the opportunities, and hopefully, you know, this golden age, as they call it, of television and people investing in television and realising that you can, you know, tell very rich stories with, you know, the opportunity to deepen your characters over 8 hours. That's what's brilliant. It's not long form, like Andrew said. When it's really long form, you forget what you're making. You're just making it to get it to deadline and churning it out. But when you do the 6, 8, 10 parts, you have that opportunity
to control a mood.
Yeah, and just take the characters. Yeah.
The other thing that you'll notice about that is it's widescreen. When I grew up, we remember watching Robin Hood on a black and white television set that looked like that. And now the screen is largely a small cinema in your living room. Mm. So the way you write and the way you think about it has to change. You have to address it visually. You can't just have two talking heads.
No.
So landscape's obviously going to play a bigger part, and certainly movement in the frame plays a bigger part. And all this stuff is the province of the new world.
It's really film on TV, isn't it?
Well, and increasingly that's going to be it. I mean, we've been landlocked with terrestrial television, and terrestrial television requires, the commercial stations obviously have run on advertising. Now there's a whole lot of shows where you pay to watch, and that changes... that means you have a direct conduit to an audience. You do this, they pay for it. Mm. If they don't like it, they don't pay for it.
Yeah.
And that's a great model for a writer. It's a difficult business plan because you run out of stuff and you've got to constantly keep making stuff.
I think also the writer coming in as the producer, which you've been doing for a long time, Andrew, and leading the way, but that changed substantially. Like, I had creative control, if you like, and the writer just seeing it through, you know, right through to the very, very last frame and overseeing music and costume and, you know, even Anna's car, you know, the car, is fantastic to bring. So I'm telling a story through visuals and metaphors and symbology that I can control, so I can, you know, reduce the dialogue, which is brilliant because I'm terrible at dialogue, and tell a story through pictures, which is what we should be doing, but you don't always get that opportunity. But having the writer stepping up, and that's what the most exciting thing that's happening in television right now is the writer, producer model, the showrunner model.
Yes, it seems like we have been slow in Australia to take on,
really,
although
really
you've
slow.
Actually been doing it for decades, but it hasn't been called a showrunner until recently. It's
no,
a writer-producer.
It was writer-producer, and the reason I did that was first series I ever did was with John Clarke. We did a couple of series together. And I remember being very excited. I was about 28 or something, and I went out on my first day of a shoot, and we were shooting weirdly in studio and location at the same time, and I realised they were working off two entirely different scripts, two completely different drafts, and referring to one character who wasn't actually in the... And I remember coming up quietly to a first assistant director and saying, this is the wrong script. You're actually referring to a character that doesn't exist anymore. And the guy looking at me and throwing the script pretty much at me and saying, I knew we should let the fucking writer on set. And I took a mental note at that time that I needed to have a little more control. And... I do think it's incumbent, the writer-producer or the showrunner thing now, I think it's terribly important that writers who wish to do that understand how it works. Mm. You can have a whole lot of writers hanging around saying, you missed her pause on page 56. You know, there was a semicolon there. And you go out, as Vicky said, you go out to a windswept location and on Bruni Island and the truck's fallen over, and you've got to know how to work around that. You've really got to understand what everyone brings to a production. A novelist is all about writing the nuance, and I think the job of a screenwriter is to create the space for nuance, because everyone else brings that to it. And if you're going to be a showrunner, you've got to understand what they bring, what a music brings, what a production designer brings, what a grip brings. You know, there's so many people working on it that unless you can convey to them the spirit of the show and what it's about, you get lost, which is why you would have more control.
Yeah.
So you also are a showrunner.
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm a control freak. That's why I do as much as I can on the thing. I've never really written for somebody to direct that wasn't me, though. So that's quite an odd experience, I'd imagine. Like, I can't fathom that at all, for kind of giving up that control, because it's so easy to, like, I've read scripts by other people and I don't know what the fuck they're about, you know. Like, I can't picture them. Maybe that's because I'm terribly uncreative, which is very true, but also how, you know, most directors are hacks. Like, how can you expect them to interpret it unless you're incredibly didactic in your big print or whatever?
And then they resent
it,
that
we call it letting go.
Never.
<Networking. laughs>
I once had a director come back having shot a script of mine. This is in the very early days before I was producing, and said, look, it's great. I didn't really read it. I just kind of used it as a roadmap. And by God, that's what it should have been used for.
Do you think, Andrew, that networks are now much more open to the idea of the writer-showrunner, or are we still a long way?
Oh, look, no, behind? I don't think so. Commercial networks have a very different view of the world. I think they're a dinosaur, and it's not being critical of them. I just think they run on a commercial paradigm, and increasingly audiences are going away to other media. So the only thing they can do are programs where people get voted off islands or cry over the failed zucchini flan or something. And I think you're going to find that is increasingly the nature of commercial television. They are obliged to produce programs. And God bless them. You know, they'll do 26 parters just because they're obliged to have an Australian content.
But does that make the non-commercial and the streaming services more more risk takers, maybe. If we say the commercial are doing that, then yes. Does that mean the ABC and the other streaming services and the web then become a more fertile ground for creatives?
They should. I'm not sure that Foxtel's delivering. I thought your show was great, and exactly the sort of thing that they need to be exploring. But Foxtel for years was really just taking commercial fodder and running it and putting right down to putting commercials in it. And if you're paying $100 a month for the privilege of watching Gilligan's Island reruns, it's kind of stupid. They've got to come up with new programming. I'll get that word out. But they've also got to... They've got 42 different platforms that you can watch programs on, and I'll be damned if I can tell the difference between several of them. I think there's... and they're now being forced through Netflix, although Netflix Australia isn't nearly as good as Netflix America. They're getting forced into actually defining who they are and what they are, and I think you'll get more interesting programming out of that in the end. Fairly conservative at the moment, the Australian market.
And in terms of sort of youth-orientated programming, not that I can really vouch for the youth now that I'm 25, but none of my friends watch
Believe
anything.
Believe me, you can. Yeah.
I think you can.
But, like, none of my friends have Foxtel. I don't know anybody who has Foxtel who isn't a parent of one of my friends.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who watches channels 9, 7 or 10
yeah.
that isn't a parent of one of my friends. Yeah. I know a lot of friends' parents. But, like, I don't even have commercial TV in my house because I moved into a new house recently and it didn't get the aerial feed. And then, like, the only way I noticed is 2 months later I was listening to the radio and they were advertising MasterChef, and I was like, I didn't even know that was on. What a fucking dream. Like, it was great. Like, I missed nothing because I've got Netflix, Stan, Presto, and YouTube. Yeah. Why would I ever care to go on Channel 7 to watch Keeping Up with the Habibs or whatever that was that came out?
So when we talk about television, Michael, what does it mean to you in terms of you're young, obviously, where you want your career to go? Is it to stay on the web and keep doing what you're doing?
Yeah. There was kind of a cognitive dissonance in me whereupon I never watched TV, but I really wanted to be on it because I thought, like, that'll legitimize me. Then I'll show mum. And, you know, then kind of as soon as we got Wizards onto television, it became this TV show, which was a massive deal for my ego. After it broadcast, I was like, yeah, but still more people are going to watch it online. And that turned out to be the case. And it's this weird thing where I'd been on the web for so long that I desperately wanted to get on television to validate my soul. And meanwhile, people on TV are like, how do we get online? What's our viral content? And so there was this crossover here. And I now realize that TV doesn't really mean an awful lot, I suppose. Like, it's just series now and streaming. TV, even as a term, doesn't have an impact. Like, I don't know anybody who watches something at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday anymore. No, that's just out the window. So I studied visual effects in my spare time in high school, and that was because I knew that it would allow me freedom when it came to being a writer, going back to the point of this discussion. Because normally, I suppose, if you're writing something and you suddenly want... we have a gag in episode 3 where the main character's on a date and he gets a bit too drunk, and she sort of confesses, like, oh, I always wanted to go to the moon when I was a kid. I always wanted to be an astronaut. And he's like, well, let's go to the moon. Bang, zoom, straight to the moon. And they teleport to the moon, and she just immediately decompresses and, like, explodes to death on the moon. And that was just the funniest way for me to end the scene. But I guess on a normal show, you'd have to get approval for that joke because you'd need to have the budget in order to do that visual effect, in order to take people away to the moon and suddenly blow up a character.
Only because we're hamstrung by technology. Any of that would play well on television.
Hopefully.
I just think we got hamstrung with the size of crews, hamstrung with the technology. There's people, you know, like me, who haven't really aren't very much across technical stuff anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most producers would have read those scripts and thought that they were unachievable, particularly on a budget, because there were 640 VFX shots throughout the show, and our budget was about $350,000. But I knew, because me and the producer would be doing the visual effects by ourselves, that it just didn't matter. Like, let's just write the funniest show that we can. Mm. And in that way, it was interesting that from a writing point of view, having this technical skill meant that I was, like, it just allowed another creative freedom, I guess, when it came to writing.
Well, you can argue, can't you? Well, I know we can do this.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I didn't, but I knew that, like, well, it just ruins my year for a couple more weeks while I figure it out.
Mm. I mean, Andrew and Vicky, do you find, obviously, you're not the special effects wizard, this guy is, but do you find that you kind of censor yourself when you're writing as, oh, well, that won't be possible, or that will be too expensive, or, you know, have you got a sort of producer network in your head while you write?
I've got an old voice that says that, but I've got children that say, no, you can do that, especially my son, who's not similar in what he's doing. And... Now, increasingly, I write stuff around that. But most of the stuff I write is fairly... John Clark once said that if there's a short way of saying something, I'll take the coastal route. and that doesn't really suit special effects all that much. So most of my stuff is fairly narrative. But I like... No, I mean, I just did Hacksaw Ridge, which was all special effects. And it's liberating. And I think the more those worlds can coalesce, the better, really.
Mm. I just started writing a new series, and this is sort of the first time I've written something like that more within the system than certainly Wizards, which was really anarchic and really just, like, out of the system. And I'm working with a great script editor. One of the first questions he asked me when we started to talk about the episodes was... sort of what's our budget going to be, meaning what are we writing our budget to? And that was a really foreign concept to me because I'd only ever worked under the assumption I'd have no money, so therefore I had unlimited money. and so now coming into the right, this new series, I'm still just keeping that up and we'll figure out the budget later, because I'll just, you know, kill another 6 months of my life.
Well, what's interesting is the stuff you're doing there is marrying stuff that will abuse and entertain, that's human. The stuff that it's become dominant in all these American films at the moment is special effect fights and other special effect.
Mm.
I watched Transformer the other on a plane, and I lost the will to live. I mean, someone crash this plane, please. And it was just one special effect fights another special effect.
To quote George Lucas, a special effect without a story is a pretty boring thing. Yeah. And look at how much he upheld that own belief.
Yeah. Vicky, with Kettering, did you find that? It's a big budget show.
Do you know what? I was still finding my way with Supernatural, and I just decided the first draft was going to be my draft that I wrote what I wanted to write, and gave it to the directors and said, you know, this is your problem for a while. Because we had some clever people that have worked on a lot of films with special effects. But I didn't want it to be all special effects either. It really has to work, I think, in the more traditional sense of, so it doesn't become just a special effects bonanza. You have to ask yourself, you know, what you're trying to achieve in terms of story. But there were a couple of things I really wanted. We had a lot of moths, for example, and you know, we had some sort of strange things going on. And sometimes we hit the mark and sometimes we didn't. And sometimes I did feel there was a bit of a, you know, convoluted way of going about things where I thought, you know, I'm sure we could get a young whiz in here to do something like this. And I think that's what we need to be able to look at in commercial TV, is not be afraid of these young people with their whiz-bang skills. But there is a bit of an old school, oh, it's got to cost a lot of money and it's got to take six of us to do it. Mm. When you do watch things and like that, it's incredible. You know, it's a very impressive thing. So I do think we've got a long way to go, but I do think it's fantastic that people like Michael are coming in and moving into TV to open us all up, you know, and allow this bigger narrative and bigger story.
Force our retirement earlier.
Exactly, bring it on.
I would also say it's definitely much harder to do in a dramatic sense, because whilst I can do some visual effects, I certainly can't do anything that holds up to the dramatic pinnacle that is Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen. But in a sort of goofy, absurdist world like the Wizard's world, you can have a bit of a crappy edge around a rotoscope or a green screen that holds up.
I remember doing Fast Forward. The cheaper the effect, the better the laugh, really. Mm. Yeah.
I recently saw
Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the beginning.
Hmm. Even modern Doctor Who. I recently saw a trailer for a monster film, and at the end of the trailer they show the monster, and the monster just looked so unconvincing that that's going to undo the whole film. Mm. But if the film was silly and was absurd and was kind of taking the mickey, who am I, my granddad? then it could get away with kind of a shonky digital effect.
Do you think this golden age of television has allowed a much more interesting exploration of character? I'll ask all of you that, but throw to you first. An in-depth... Are we allowed to go places we weren't allowed to go to before with TV?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first series I wrote with John Clark, John found it the other day, a note from the ABC saying there's four bloodies in this episode and we're going to have to... We will allow two. So language, everything was restricted when we started.
And there's a lot of farks in rake.
Well, and there's a lot of farks in rake. In fact, ridiculous amount. Which isn't answering a question. The answer is shorter series allows you to develop character. The mantra used to be, when you were starting out, I always ignored it, but we started out saying a character to sustain a series must never change. Mm. They must be a constant. There's a great writer called John Alsop who said that the problem with commercial television, this is some years back, is that we take a interesting human being, full of complexities, full of contradictions, full of anger, full of love, full of all the things that make up a complex human person, and then give each of those parts to a different actor. So the great thing about having a short-run thing is you can really explore character. You can allow them to change. They can be inconsistent.
Vicky, character is very important to Kettering, obviously.
Kettering at its heart is a very character-driven show, and it was always really important to do that and to have one big story where you can explore the characters. But I think something went really wrong with Australian television. I mean, certainly when I grew up, there was like The Box and number 96 that I was never allowed to watch back in those days, and really bawdy comedy, especially in the UK. Because my mum was English, we ended up watching a lot of Morecambe and Wise and those kinds of old, really old shows. And, then we just went through this, I don't know, the 80s and 90s, and everything became sterile and you weren't allowed to, they count up your bloodies or how to get around things. So on that level, I think we've gone way, 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 way too far. But on the other hand, I think we are starting to do some interesting TV we have had it dotted all the way through. It's just a matter of, producers pushing stuff through and writers again coming to the fore and having this format now. I mean, when I was working in the UK, the eight-parter wasn't in Australia. We didn't have it. We had the four-parter, which was big budget and big, big, big stories, and now you can take a simple idea, if you like, and run it through eight episodes and do a really, really good character exploration. So that is the beauty of it. Whether it can sustain, it's not bringing in loads of jobs or anything, but I think there's a market for everything. And to be able to sit on the world stage and to be able to talk to writers, in the States who are making those shows, or for me, in Denmark, making those shows and being able to, sit alongside them and think that we can do this here, which we always could do. It's just been having an outlet like Foxtel or Stan slowly and Netflix if they do commission. We need more commissioning. We need those guys to be commissioning more and taking big chances.
We have to stop there and throw to the audience for some questions. So has anybody got a question? I think there's a microphone flying around. And you can direct it to any of the panel or all of them, however you wish.
Thank you. I think everyone could probably have a go at this. But just in regards to marketing and how much maybe traditional programs could embrace the world of online and things like that in order to generate... I know there's been a bit of a sense before that you need to create actual content, for your marketing, or create interactive shows to bring online. But whether or not you could actually... Like, the great thing about that trailer of Wizards of Oz is just how much you just want to watch that sort of thing. And do we create those sorts of trailers which go onto YouTube, which bring kids who are watching YouTube back to the TV and things like that? I was just one other smaller side would be, like, with Vincent Sheen and his work that he's obviously done through Blue Tongue and things like that. The Blue Tongue films are fantastic, but they don't really seem to find an audience, and maybe that's because those guys are so much in Hollywood and they're still thinking that old-fashioned sort of trailer, posters, put in the cinema and hope it sells.
One thing I'd say about this experience with Kettering, Foxtel did a huge marketing campaign with it, and a lot of it was online, and it's been really revealing to have to, because there's big expectation from us as the creators to interact and to go into that world and, never read online remarks about your show. And it's been, for me, it's just been a real eye-opener how important that that advertising is and the teasers going on to YouTube and how many hits they get there. It's extraordinary. So I think it is the way that it is now. It's a really big marketing campaign that is an online campaign that we do need to embrace more. And I know Kettering has had a huge... online presence, and I think that's definitely overseas. I've been talking about it a lot before it's even shown over there, and a lot of that is watching YouTube, and you can just tell by their remarks. They're just saying you know, they've seen this on YouTube. So I think it's really important these days, and it's almost necessary.
Do you want to respond to that, Michael?
I'm probably not quite on topic, but when SBS started advertising the show, they did a really good traditional marketing push, and as such, we got pretty better ratings than we were expected to get, and they did great in getting us interviews with all the main newspaper outlets and pushes on their channel as well. But when it came to online stuff, I think that their online marketing for the show was maybe a little confused, and I don't know if they necessarily knew the best way to they would select little clips and make little memes as GIFs, and for whatever reason they didn't super catch on. But I actually cut that trailer myself, and I just put that on YouTube, and somebody shared it on Reddit, and it got to the top of Reddit. And I think that kind of speaks to your point of just embracing that online spirit. And from there, people on Tumblr were sharing GIFs of it and stuff like that. So it really appealed to the international online market via that in a way that the network sort of didn't quite. But I still want funding for this new show. I'm sorry.
Another question?
I was just kind of interested in the positives and negatives of then versus now. So maybe a bit more for Andrew and Vicky. Do you miss anything about the old days, I guess, of writing?
I don't remember the old days.
That means you lived
there. Yeah. The positives of the old days was that when I was Michael's age, you got a break, and you got money, and you're allowed to go out and stuff up. And I got together with the Working Dog guys then, then with Magda and Marg and Jane and all those sort of people. So yeah, I had a wonderful time where you knew you're on the zeitgeist, because you knew that in some cases a third of the country was watching your show, that was good. When you reach an age of sexual implausibility, which I did many years ago, it no longer becomes important to be on the zeitgeist, but important to tell stories to people in a different way. And what I like now is the ability to just work on the craft, really, and explore what you can actually get out of the medium. I don't know that I'm doing it, but it's certainly an interesting time. It's a very good time to be me, but I don't know how good it is for people starting out.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think I'd have to say I came up through Crawford's, and the training and trying at the moment to do everything I can to help emerging writers, but it's quite hard. You take on attachments, but there's a real gulf there. And so I guess I missed that, because I was so lucky, coming up through Crawford's. But I also missed there was something about the camaraderie, on Flying Doctors, and I was a junior, but the writers were rock stars. They'd come in, we had all these Matt Gudgeons, and these writers were really just amazing, and that magic has gone away a little bit. It feels now like I work for a living, and there's not a lot of joy anymore, and I think there's reduced... The biggest thing that I always bang on about is the reduced time we have to produce TV in the writers' room, across the board, but mainly in the writers' room. And I try and bring it up all the time, because it's a really, really difficult. We get squeezed down now. It's 2 or 3 weeks to write a first draft, and then you get loads of notes at the last minute, and everybody's under pressure, and everybody's angry, and depressed. So come and work in TV. So it is really difficult, and it has pushed a lot of people out of the business. So I do miss this simpler way of, which probably goes back to simpler storytelling as well. So it's a bit of a pros and cons, I guess.
It's interesting too, just to go back to the appointment TV idea. you know, Sea Change, for example, it would be an event. You know, you'd watch it, I can't remember, is it a Sunday night? But,
yeah.
I mean, I wonder if we have lost anything in that sort of communal watching of, you know, the Who Killed Laura Palmer or the, you know, the water cooler moment where everyone watched at the same time and everyone was at the same point in a series. And now...
Yeah. We have such big expectations now that everything is criticised. You know, it's too slow, it's not this, it's not that. We're all, because we can switch and we can turn off and there's a huge amount to choose from. And you've got to remember in Australia as well, our budget's about one-tenth of what they make other shows for overseas. And yeah, they appreciate overseas. Mm. They say, what did you make your show for? And they kind of astounded when you say, you know, 50 million's a lot of money. I'm thinking... You know, wow, we've spent $50 million. Then I spoke to a friend of mine who worked on Penny Dreadful, and that was the money for their first episode.
Yeah, like, no, The Bridge, which everyone loved, had a 15-day shoot per hour.
Really?
And that's in a Scandinavian country. There's only 9 people living there. in Australia, Jack Irish... which we were shooting, the last series we shot in Manila, and here we had Guy Pearce and you know, a really big cast. We had 7 days, 7.5 days to shoot it. And I'd love that to change.
Yeah, that would be good.
In the media in recent months, I've seen some stories, and I went to a couple of author events, and there seemed to be a story that it's very difficult for women to get into the writing business, that it's extraordinarily dominated by male voices and male scriptwriters.
Can you stop asking that question, please?
So something like 80% is male and 20% is female. Is that true across television and film for Australia?
Be surprised by those numbers.
I think it's about 26% on the Gender Matters Screen Australia, 26% female screenwriters across film and television are female.
Yeah.
Vicky, do you want to talk
about look, it's true. There's not a lot of females, and it's a hard gig. Like, when you're in production, and I'm just going to go back to, because I said this at a Gender Matters talk, you know, they've given a whole lot of money out, which is fantastic, to bring more women into the business. But for me, it's about asking the question of why they're not in the business. That question has to be asked, because it goes back to, for me, the time constraints that have been put on the business that literally drives people out. And you have to, when we were shooting Kettering in any show, once you're in production or even leading up to it, you're just working till 11, 12 at night, starting again at 7 in the morning. It is brutal and it is ruthless and it is, you know, high tension, high anxiety. And a lot of my girlfriends who have been writers and working in the business have literally opted out to write books or do something else because they actually want a life. And I'm sure there are men that do too, but I think men are just a little bit more used to, they don't mind that kind of, you know, long wear and tear. But I really feel the questions have to be asked about why they're not in the business, because you can. I mean, I've survived, and it is very male-dominated, I'm not going to lie. There's a lot of stuff that probably wouldn't get through HR that exists in other industries, you know, that, and it's a small business, so you can't complain, to be honest. And if you do, people find out about it. So I just think women just kind of are not attracted to it when it's going to take up that much of their life. But I do think it's a conversation that I know I have a lot with my friends, and especially some of my girlfriends, who just go, I don't know how you do it. And I just say, because it's all I want to do, but it has come at a big cost, to be honest.
I also think many of the decision-making, I mean, that's starting to change too, but I think a lot of the programmers were male for a very long time at that echelon. And, you know, it's true that people do naturally want to see stories that reflect their own experience. And I think if you look at the golden age of television, it's, you know, it's very much... Those early years of the HBO stories were very male-driven, and it's shifted now. But, you know, your Don Drapers and your Walter Whites and, you know, The Sopranos, and, you know, you could go on. Deadwood, the very male stories, and, you know, women have to get up to those positions of power to go, no, I actually want to see different sort of stories. And I think it's about the people who make those decisions about which stories we tell is also something that needs to shift. We've got time to maybe one more.
Like you're saying, that, you know, we're binging out on horror and, you know, the political correctness is getting better and we can swear and do all these things, but interestingly, on stage, we can't in Australia. There's a little bit of a difference. What I'm trying to say is what I'm aiming at is some more comedic talent on our screens from Australian women, truly using their voice, whoever they fuck they want.
Yeah, I actually think that part of the thing is that women aren't... I'm not trying to generalise here, but the sort of stories that women want to tell are not the stories that men even get. So I actually think I think it's really important that women start making more programs. You just saw something like Kath and Kim take off in Australia, and it's actually one of the few programs that got a huge audience. I didn't watch it, but I know lots of people, women did and loved it. And I think there's a whole... There's got to be ways of just splitting it in half. Yeah, there's... Same with Parliament. 50%, just do it. Whatever it takes to get there.
And, yeah, it possibly does come down to the fact that these people in positions of power who have been able to authorise shows to get created have been traditionally male roles in the past. And I'd like to think that's changing with little initiatives like Gender Matters, et cetera, but also like the meteoric rise of things like The Catering Show, the prequel to The Catering Incident.
Yeah.
And, I know...
It's the illegitimate daughter of that, yes.
Sketchy have kind of gone crazy up in Sydney, and Skitbox, another kind of female comedy group, they're getting a show made in ABC at the moment. Mm. So I think that the landscape has begun to change.
Yes. I mean, we're living in a country that, last year... until a slight leadership change, the Minister for Women was a man. I mean...
And we're probably going to see more as well from the fact that YouTube now exists, and now that there isn't necessarily a gatekeeper in order to get stuff seen, because our biggest platform is actually something that's free access by everybody. Mm. And so it's just as easy to make a vlog and get a bajillion views. That's probably more successful than whatever comedy series is on channel... whatever at the moment.
I think we have to wrap it up. I'd like you all to thank our terrific panel, Andrew, Vicky and Michael.
And thank you, Elise McCready, who never even introduced herself and who's a damn fine writer in her own regard.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.